top secret. For senior officer. Immediate. Decipher and pass to all relevant sections. 17th of July. Intelligence Insight. Number 012.
Welcome to this Bletchley Park Intelligence Insight. Bletchley Park is an independent charity, and so we rely on the ticket sales of our visitors for 95% of our operating costs. But another way to support the museum is to become a friend of Bletchley Park. As a friend of Bletchley Park, you not only get our normal, free, unlimited, year-round access to our heritage site and museum, but a range of other benefits, including exclusive events, previews and discounts, all while knowing you're helping us to keep telling the story of the vital war-winning work carried out by the men and women of the Government Code and Cipher School during World War II. So in this episode, we take you back to early 2018 and to one of those exclusive Friends Talks from our very own research historian, Dr. David Kenyon. The Y Service was the organisation responsible for intercepting enemy wireless and radio communications with Y stations based all around the world. In his talk, David focused on a smaller part of this organisation, the Coastal Y Service. In the Q&A that follows his talk, who better to help him than Pat Davies, who, from 1942 to 1945, was one of those intercept operators for the Royal Navy. Post-war, Pat had an astonishing career as a journalist, documentary maker, and television producer. In June 2019, the French government awarded her the Légion d'honneur. But now, over to David.
My role is the research historian here, so my function essentially is to make sure that everything that Bletchley Park tells to you, be it in exhibitions or online or anywhere else, has a foundation in verifiable fact. And given that this is an organisation that was very secret for a very long time, that isn't always an easy job. But it's a very satisfying job for me. Essentially, they pay me a wage to sit in an office down there overlooking the lake and read books about World War II all day, which is not a hard life. What I'm going to talk to you today about is one tiny but important part of the greater GC&CS scheme of things, which is, as the title suggests, land-based Royal Navy VHF intercept stations during the war, otherwise known as Coastal Y. This talk sort of came about, if you like, partly because of this map. This map is down in Block C, and is in the case explaining about the Y service. And it's slightly in the wrong place because most of that case talks about the Y service that we're familiar with, Morse intercept up at Scarborough, Flower Down, all around the world, listening to dots and dashes and writing them down. However, as it says down here, this is for VHF communications, and this is a separate Y organisation listening to German voice traffic. The raison d'etre for this is convoys. And most people are very familiar with the idea of convoys crossing the Atlantic, bringing goods from the US and Canada, and the war that was involved in the Atlantic with the U-boats and everything else. That's the, if you like, the glamorous and famous side of convoy work in the Second World War. The distinctly unglamorous part were the coastal convoys that sailed around the shores of the UK. These are absolutely crucial to the UK's survival because most parts of the UK were not connected well enough to other parts to shift bulk goods. I'm talking particularly about coal. Just London alone, for example, requires something like 10 million tonnes of coal a year just to survive. You can't deliver that by rail or by road. You can only deliver it by coastal shipping. This has been going on since the 19th century, and you have a long-standing tradition of quite small vessels, up to 1,000 tonnes, many privately owned or owned by small shipping companies, doing this coastal trade. And it was poorly paid, grim work, even in peacetime. Coastal waters around the UK are navigationally very treacherous, and there wasn't a huge amount of money to be made, so it's a pretty grim job. This job was made even worse in 1939 by the interference of the Germans, and in addition, the creation of the protective minefields that were laid permanently around the UK. The East Coast Barrage, as it's called, is this one down here, and the gap between the barrage and the coast was in many cases only a couple of miles wide. It was a very narrow corridor, which made navigation so that you didn't, on the one hand, hit Hull, and on the other hand, you didn't hit a mine, was pretty difficult. And of course, the Germans were attacking these convoys. Because of the depth of the water, we're not talking typically about submarine activity. in the North Sea and around the Channel. We're more particularly focusing on Schnellboote, what the Allies refer to as E-boats, the E standing for enemy. And they're basically fast patrol vessels armed with torpedoes and quite commonly as well mines. And the methods of attack, they would come over at night and they would, at high speed, attack the coastal convoys, either by torpedo or quite often they would get into the coastal channel and they would basically block it with a row of mines and then sail out again. And when the convoy arrived later, obviously the convoy would hit the mines. So doing something about these vessels is really, really important. And after the fall of France in 1940, the French coastal ports, right up as far as Calais, become available to the Germans to base these vessels. So the channel basically becomes a very, very dangerous place at that point. This particular vessel survived the whole war and surrendered in Felixstowe in 1945. This is boat S204. And we know the captain of this vessel was a chap by the name of Corvetten Captain Fimmen. And I will come back to him at the end of the lecture because we have other information about him. So yes, you have all these E-boats. So how do you challenge E-boats at night? The answer lies in their communications. Communications we're familiar with in terms of Enigma and regular Y stations, that's HF, high-frequency radio. And because it bounces off the ionosphere, it can travel halfway around the world, you can communicate with people out in the middle of the Atlantic. VHF doesn't do that. VHF signals typically only travel sort of horizon distance, so they're limited to 20, 30 miles. So the Kriegsmarine in particular tended only to use voice communication for short-range conversation between warships. And in particular, if you had a squadron of ships operating together, they could chat away quite happily because their signals would not be audible beyond about 30 miles. If you imagine the voice communications of the Bismarck, you would basically be under its guns before you heard it. So in major naval operations out on the ocean, VHF is not particularly significant. In the channel, on the other hand, which is perhaps only, you know, is as narrow as 20 miles wide, these voice communications can be heard from on shore. And that's where Coastal Y comes in, because it became possible, especially if you sat on top of a cliff and got yourself a bit higher up, got a further horizon, you could hear enemy VHF communications. And one of the advantages is it's not typically heavily encrypted. It was voice traffic. Sometimes they would use code phrases in their talking, but a lot of it is just simply people chatting away over the radio. Prior to 1939, the main listening operations were focused on high-frequency communications and radio traffic that was coming from far out in the Atlantic or wherever else, or Germany. This is the station at Flowerdown, down near Winchester, and this was one of the Navy stations for HF intercept. The other station they had was up at Scarborough, and that indeed continues in the form of a GCHQ listening station to this day. There was an incident in February 1940 when Scarborough started to hear plain language VHF traffic. Sometimes quirks of atmosphere allow these signals to travel further. They could be intercepted further away. But in February, somebody suddenly picked up a lot of German and Norwegian conversation, voice communication, coming from Norway. This was actually associated with the freighter Altmark. Altmark is famous in other circles because it was used by the Germans to store captured crews from British merchantmen that had been sunk. And it's famous for the Navy raiding it and freeing the prisoners in a very spectacular boarding operation, which made the press in 1940. But also around that time, Scarborough was hearing these German and Norwegian voices talking about that. So they went around the office, and there was only one person in the office they found who spoke both German and Norwegian. This is a chap called Leslie Marshall, known as Freddy, who at the time was an ordinary seaman signaller. But they said to Marshall, can you listen to these and make some sense of it? And so he had a listen and was able to translate the traffic and pass on the intelligence information to the powers that be. And at that point, kind of a light bulb went on and they thought, well, if we can hear this VHF voice traffic, we should be intercepting it. We should be trying to listen to it and gain its intelligence value. So in June 1940, Marshall was sent here. This is South Foreland Lighthouse, just above Dover. It's now owned by the National Trust. It's originally a 19th century construction. This photograph is from 1949. And you can actually see Nissen huts in the background and various other bits and pieces because South Foreland became a very significant electronic warfare institution as the war progressed. There's a chain home station next door. There's a chain home low station. There's a variety of radar activity there as well. But at this period, the lighthouse was disused and they thought this would be a great spot to see if they could listen to the Germans. So Freddie Marshall was promoted to signalman and sent down to South Foreland with some VHF receivers, which were installed in the back of a van. and he drove his van to South Foreland, parked it up, and started listening to the Germans. He was assisted by wireless operators from an outfit called the Civilian Shore Wireless Service. These were mostly retired naval signalmen who were recruited, remaining as civilians, to be involved in various wire service operations. So he was given some German-speaking Civilian Shore Wireless Service people, and they started listening to E-boats, ideally. Slight problem was that one of them was Swiss, spoke German better than he spoke English, and one night the house was raided by a patrol of Royal Marines looking for spies parachuted in, invaders of one sort and another. And a man who only spoke German, sitting in a van on a lonely clifftop with a wireless set, obviously excited their interest. Fortunately, Freddie Marshall turned up in time to rescue his Swiss colleague, but it was all a bit Heath Robinson at this point. It was immediately obvious that traffic could be intercepted, German vessels could be identified. So a system was extended along the south coast to provide this service. An early photograph we have of one of those setups is this one. This is the Portland Bill. There's an old lighthouse and keeper's cottages on Portland Bill. Again, this is now a rather pleasant holiday home, so if you want to go and stay there, you can. This is a theme we will return to in the course of this lecture. But you can see the signals van outside. You can also see where the signals van has been strapped down with ties so that it doesn't blow off the cliff, which was a major problem with these early vans, because they would find these incredibly bleak locations on top of cliffs right next to the sea and then all sit in a van. And seasickness among the operators was apparently a problem because the whole van would just rock from side to side throughout the night. The staff they put in these, from a quite early period, they started using German-speaking male signals personnel, but they were running out of them quite quickly. So they sought out German-speaking Wrens, the female Navy personnel, and they were installed in these stations. The sexism of the era continued in the sense that the Wrens were allowed to listen to the traffic and write down the communications, but the radio sets had to be maintained by male operators. So on each shift, there would be a male signalman who was in charge of the technical aspect and two female Wrens doing the listening. The reason there were two was because it wasn't considered fit to leave one on their own in a rocking van with a male signalman overnight. So they did subsequently train female technicians to run the wireless sets. And there's one of the Wrens who described in her own account of things that this was a great relief to them all because it meant that they all got double the amount of sleep because they could go on shift one at a time after that. The other story from Portland Bill is that the van leaked so much that they all wore their tin helmets while they were on duty because it kept the rain off their heads. So you have to appreciate at this point, like many, many things in 1940, early 1941, it's a bit make, do and mend. They're trying to create an operation on the hoof. Latterly, as I say, they got more organised and these stations become an almost entirely female preserve. You would have a team of 8 to 12 Wren listening operators. They would be supported by a cook and a steward who looked after their meals. And as I said, latterly, either one male civilian wireless service technician or latterly Wren technicians who were trained up to do that job as well. And they were posted in these remote points along the coast. One of the features of it was the whole operation was secret. So they weren't supposed to tell anyone what they were doing and they had to try and keep a low profile. They all wore civilian clothes at this period. And the idea was that somehow that, you know, a dozen women living in a lonely cottage on a clifftop wouldn't attract anyone's attention. But that was what they were dealing with. The communication system for relaying their intelligence back to the powers that be was initially very poor. The initial procedure in 1940 was the traffic was taken down longhand. They basically wrote down what the Germans said. And then every day they would bundle it up into a parcel. And one of the Wrens would go down to the post office and send it, recorded delivery, to the Admiralty. Again, Daphne Humphreys, who was at South Foreland, describes in 1940 that each day she would go to the post office and dictate the same secret address to the postmistress as she had the day before. And she used this lovely phrase, the elderly postmistress, DSD-9, dear, the Admiralty, is that right? Yes, yes, same again, same as yesterday. The other problem she had was that they were paid in cash by the Royal Navy purser in Dover, and she wasn't able to collect the wages unless she was fully dressed in uniform and presented herself properly at the naval station. But she had to leave here in civilian clothes because it was secret. So she kept her uniform in a bag and would change behind a hedge on her way down into Dover. It's 1940. This is how life went. Fortunately, as I say, the service became a great deal more organised because it became apparent that this postal intelligence service was just not rapid enough. There were incidents of German vessels being identified as they sailed all the way up the channel and off to Holland. And 3 days later, someone in the Admiralty would go, do you know a German destroyer went past on Wednesday? It's not very helpful. So they revised the system whereby they had direct telephone links from the Y stations into the local Navy command centres. And the Navy has a number of posts around the UK, which were their sort of local area commands. And there'll be a telephone link from the individual coastal Y stations to those commands. And subsequently as well, a second team of German-speaking Wrens who would be embedded in the local command centre. And they could then gather the information from their colleagues and pass it on to the local operation centres. And the whole system became much more sort of real-time efficient, if you like. In addition to that, any traffic that they picked up, and some of it was in cipher as well, either verbal ciphers or some of it was some Morse as well, all of that would be bagged up and sent to Bletchley Park for additional analysis, and the, you know, more intelligence value could be extracted from it. This is Fort Southwick in Portsmouth. This is where the Naval Command Centre down there was based. Fort Southwick is one of the forts up on top of Portsdown Hill above Portsmouth. And they were able to tunnel into the chalk to a significant depth and create an underground bomb-proof command centre. It had an air conditioning system, but whoever was in charge of it didn't seem to think it needed to be switched on most of the time. And the description is climbing to the top of the stairs at the end of the shift and kind of basking in the taste of fresh air when you came back out. Because like all these places, like the huts here, you have to imagine everyone smoked down there as well. But the system by this point is pretty organised because you have a constant team down here with the phone links out to the Y station, so that if any German traffic is heard, they can pass it on straight away. One of the other features which gets remarked on is the similar operation at Dover, under Dover Castle. Many of you are aware there's a whole tunnel system down there that was used for naval command. They had a coastal Y cell in there as well, who were receiving communications from South Foreland, from Abbotscliff, from other places. That was a pretty grotty place to work, except for the fact that the women's heads, which is the toilets, were built with a window looking out through the face of the cliff. No one quite figured out why this was the case, but if you went and sat on the toilet in the ladies' heads, you had a panoramic view of Dover Harbour. And it was described as a great place to sit and watch air raids. And this takes us back to the map. This is the Coastal Y service at its kind of peak, if you like. And you can see a network of stations, starting with Blyth up there in Northumberland, Scarborough, Withernsea, and this is the Naval Command in Hull. And then all of the East Anglian stations reporting to the Nore down here, Dover Command, CNC Portsmouth and CNC Plymouth. And so you can see by 1942, you have this quite sophisticated system of intelligence listening, both the telephone links into the stations and then the connection back to Bletchley Park. Ultimately, there are 18 of these establishments. There are documents in the National Archives which give you the full list and what was going on at each place. We have Peterhead, which is off the top of this map, actually. It's up in Scotland, but it was closed down fairly early on. Withernsea, Blyth, Sheringham, Trimmingham, Winterton, Southwold, Harwich, North Foreland, South Foreland, Portsdown Hill, Portland Bill, Lyme Regis, Torquay, Lou, Coverack, Hartland Point, and St David's. And that gives you the whole circuit. Actually, there's more stations than you need here. It was found that by the time you get into the Irish Sea, the intercepts dropped off substantially. This is partly because there's a lot more space. The Germans aren't necessarily in range of the coastal stations. Got the whole of the North Sea, but the German E-boat operations, they're trying to penetrate inside the minefields and run up and down close to the coast. So they make themselves available for intercept at that point. The locations of these various stations, they were looking for places that were firstly available, secondly, ideally on high ground if they could find it, and obviously as close to the sea as they could get. After 1940, the coastal tourist trade has dropped off substantially, partly because some areas are closed off completely, and secondly, because people aren't going on holiday. So the coast is full of vacant hotels. And a number of these hotels became Coastal Y stations. Some of these are still hotels now. So by the joys of Google Maps, you can work your way around and identify all these various places. One day, I think there's a great touring holiday and going around and visiting them all. But they weren't just using hotels. They were also using holiday villas, private houses. And in each of these, in Abbotscliff, for example, they would set the watch rooms up in rooms that had literally a sea view, and you could sit there and look out over your bit of sea. Although, of course, mostly you were operating at night, so you wouldn't have seen anything. And certainly at Abbotscliff, latterly, they built blast walls around the ground floor of the building, so even if the blackout curtains had been open, you'd have just seen some rather crude brickwork. Lyme Regis, which I haven't mentioned, was in the golf club at Lyme Regis. Why I put this slide in is they were equipped with a wooden aerial tower. In the early days, they would simply strap a 20-foot pole to the chimney of the house, but improving technology, they were equipped with this tower, which also had a ladder up inside it so that there was a sort of platform at the top, rather like a crow's nest, So you could climb up and adjust all your aerials and sort out your equipment up there. And that's where they were doing the listening from. But there's two things you can do with this information. Firstly, you can record what people are saying and the fact that they are speaking at all. Second thing you can do is you can take a bearing on the source of the transmission and you can do what they call direction finding, where if you listen from two places and you get a bearing from those two places of where the signal is strongest, obviously the crossover gives you a location, a reasonably precise location for the transmitter and thus the enemy ship. And this was done latterly from 1942 onwards using these things. This is a coastal DF tower. This one is at Sheringham. And what you have essentially is a blast wall at the bottom to protect the operator. And then this timber structure, it was actually two sets of timber planks with gravel in between, which was intended to provide a sort of blast protection. Wireless aerial on the top, quite simple to operate. The mast comes down through to the bottom and there's the equivalent of a car steering wheel on the bottom that you revolve. You have a pair of headphones on, you revolve the wheel. And actually, they discovered that it was easier to hear the signal when it was weakest rather than when it was strongest. So you basically turn the wheel until the signal fades out, and then you take a reciprocal bearing on that, and that is the direction of the transmission. These stations were typically operated by a single wren who would be sent out there, obviously typically at night, and there was a bunk in here, they were allowed to sleep, but they had a telephone from the main watch room, and if a signal was intercepted, phone would ring, they'd jump out of bed, start cranking the handle, and try and establish a bearing. The moral security of these women was also protected. They were all issued with a service revolver so that while they were sleeping in their pyjamas in this hut, if a German paratrooper came to get them, they could defend themselves. Unfortunately, Freddie Marshall recalled on one occasion going to inspect one of his girls in her DF tower. He knocked on the door and opened the door and was confronted by a woman in her pyjamas with a service revolver pointed at his head. Whether she actually knew how to fire it was a different question, but he retreated. These were typically built a couple of hundred yards away from the main watch room because the two stations tended to interfere with one another if they're too close together. So in each case, you have the main watch room and station building, and then at a distance from it, there would be the DF tower. These are quite interesting structures because, you know, as I say, 16 of them were built, but relatively few of them survive. And in many cases, what survives is only this brick part, and they have been misinterpreted all around the country. If you look in the historic environment records, the local archaeology service, they will call them pillboxes. Some cases they refer to them as direction finding stations, but think that's actually a radio beacon for aircraft navigation rather than a hostile direction finding operation. But once you know what they look like, you can start tracking them down. And Google Earth is wonderful for these things. Once you know what you're looking for, you can start scanning around to see these. They look hexagonal in sort of vertical, so you can spot them. And being an archaeologist by trade, I love things that are ruined, so this is kind of my flesh and blood. I'd now like to talk a little bit about the people who manned these stations. As I say, they were wrens. This is a photograph from Greenwich, because initially, when they started to be recruited, their basic training was taking place at Greenwich Naval College. The early phase of training, as far as I can tell, mostly consisted of typical naval skills like scrubbing floors, polishing shoes, and marching in time. So there was a lot of drill and a lot of cleaning, and it was only after that that women who had the particular skills they were looking for, which was principally a knowledge of German. And like all GC and CS recruiting, there was that element of, were you the right sort, which also helped. So women were selected, and then there was a top floor of the building, which was separated off, and Freddie Marshall, now promoted slightly higher, set up a training course up there where they would be taught both operating the machines and learning the relevant information about the German Navy, so they knew what would be discussed by the German operators and what their various slang terms and code references and things meant. And so they'd have a course up there with Freddie. Freddie was told by the Admiralty that although he held naval rank, he should always wear civilian clothes and basically keep it a secret. And he spent the rest of the war going around as Mr. Marshall in a tweed suit. And everyone naturally assumed he was a very senior naval officer. He wasn't, actually. He got to lieutenant commander by the end of the war. But everyone naturally assumed he was much more senior than that. So they needed women who spoke German. So amongst other things, they did actually put an appeal out on the BBC for women who spoke German to come forward. But also when people volunteered for the Wrens, their various skills would be identified during interview and early training. After they'd been at Greenwich for a while, a special establishment was set up in Wimbledon, a place called Southmead. It was a big old Victorian house in Wimbledon. And basically similar training went on. They listened to recorded German traffic, or Freddie Marshall would basically set up a speaker system and would talk German through the speaker and they would try and interpret it. Also down there, they were increasingly taught Morse, because it was realised that in addition to voice traffic, they could pick up useful Morse, which was typically not in sort of high-level Enigma-style ciphers. It's more often in simpler hand ciphers that in many cases they could actually break in the Y stations before passing them on. Oh, yes, this is Mill Hill. This is the National Institute for Medical Research. This was taken over in the latter part of the war for Wren training as well. So many Wrens who went into Coastal Y Service, but also ones who came here to work at Bletchley, went on to work in bomb operations and all that kind of thing, also trained here at Mill Hill. I suspect the Navy selects it because there's lots of stairs you can scrub, and apparently they used to use these flat roofs for doing drill as well. A fairly formidable-looking institution. It's still there. It's still used as a medical research establishment. They were billeted in a house called Rosedale, which is another Victorian villa about half a mile up the road. And the Wrens describe how, because they were trained alongside male signalmen who were doing the same job by the latter part of the war, they actually put operators on ships who had to be men. Again, the division of the sexes was quite strict, and they described having a separate lunch shift. So as they were going in, they would walk down one side of the hedge and the male signalmen would walk up the other side of the hedge and go in. Now, what they thought the Wrens were going to do to the signalmen, we don't know. The other thing apparently about Wimbledon was it was quite convenient because if they left the ground floor bathroom window open, they could all go downtown clubbing and come back and climb in back through the window, which is the thing we forget about our Bletchley veterans nowadays. They're all quite elderly, but we have to remember that during this period, they were all, you know, between 18 and 25 and quite often had quite a lively life, shall we say. So what are they actually listening to? Well, this is a typical report, interception report. A number of these are in the National Archives because each incident where Royal Navy vessels were engaged by German vessels in the Channel, they would write an operational report when they got back to harbour and describe what had gone on. And those all exist in the National Archives as individual files. And you can pull the files of particular operations and see what went on. And in the ones where Coastal Y were involved, there are reports from the senior Wrens in the Coastal Y station describing what they heard and how they were involved in the operation. This one is the night of the 24th of December, 1943, as it says up at the top. And this is convoy WP-450, which is heading past Weymouth Bay with two Hunt-class destroyers as escorts and two other steam gunboats. And at 01:45, they spotted several E-boats heading to intercept the convoy. A running battle ensued where the destroyers were firing star shell to illuminate the E-boats in order to engage them. And the E-boats were trying to manoeuvre into a torpedo firing position against the convoy. Neither actually succeeded, and the E-boats went home unscathed, but equally no vessels in the convoy were destroyed. So a bit of an inconclusive battle, but it went on for some time. And Portland Bill Y Station start to pick up messages. See here, 0223, 440 and 439 are the call signs of two of the E-boats. And you can see that the conversation going back and forth between the two boats. And this originally would have been in German, but this is the translated transcript for the benefit of the Admiralty. And this is key, for example, I wouldn't care to run ashore, which gives you an indication that they're quite close to the coast at that point. And then instructions and discussion about the battle. See, can you still see the destroyers? And he's saying, yes, destroyers at 270 and so on. You can see the discussion as they go about trying to get themselves into a position to attack. And obviously, being able to listen to this in real time is a real advantage to the defending Royal Navy vessels. And what would happen is typically, if these intercept stations started to hear particularly vital information, they could telephone it down to the operational control room, and then that information would be transmitted out to the destroyers at sea. A particularly successful episode of this was in February 1943. This is HMS Garth, which is another Hunt-class destroyer. There were a great many of these Hunt-class vessels built. They're on the small end of the destroyer scale. They're quite small vessels. They were built more or less specifically for coastal convoy protection. But there were a significant number of them built, and not only operated by the Royal Navy, some were crewed by Norwegians and by other free French sailors and things like that. But on this occasion, HMS Garth was escorting a convoy along the East Anglian coast with an old First World War destroyer called HMS Montrose. And they were coming down inside that minefield that I was talking about when some E-boats were identified coming out to try and lay mines across the path of the convoy, as I was describing earlier. Rather than attack it directly, you simply sail in a couple of miles ahead of it, lay a line of mines and disappear into the dark. But at 23:34, so just before midnight, Southwold Coastal Y Station heard the E-boats and was able to identify that there was E-boat activity in that area and that they were laying mines. So Montrose and Garth got full steam up from the convoy, shot ahead of the convoy to try and catch up with the E-boats there and then. The intercept was assisted by a naval radar station, the coastal radar station that had been installed at this point, And they were able to give a bearing off Galston, as it turns out, to the German ships. And the same drill as before, HMS Montrose fired star shell to illuminate the German vessels. And once they'd been spotted, Garth closed in and was able to sink one of the E-boats, S-71. And the operators in the Y station could actually hear the ship being attacked and sunk. And latterly, the German prisoners who were taken from the vessel tried to obfuscate about which ship they'd been on, but the Y station was able to identify the commander and say exactly which ship it had been. We are fortunate that an Admiralty photographer was in Felixstowe at the time, and a series of photographs were taken of the crew of S-71 being brought ashore. The E-boat was sunk, it was set on fire, and then Garth closed with it while it was burning and was able to recover 8 members of the crew, including the captain, from the ship before it sunk, and they were taken into Felixstowe. And you can see them here, all blindfolded, being taken off the ship. One other survivor from the E-boat was Peter the Dog, who was part of the E-boat crew and was adopted by the crew of HMS Garth. And he continued to serve on Garth until 1945. And in fact, Garth was used to take King George VI over to Normandy in late 1944. And Peter got his appointment with the King when the King came aboard on that journey. So that's an example of this system working really, really effectively. The Germans are out there in the dark. The Y stations are able to pick up their presence, cooperate with other intelligence sources and vector the Royal Navy onto them and sink them. This is what the service was all about. There's another aspect to the service, which was they discovered that the Germans were also using high-frequency voice radio traffic. Obviously, it travels a bit further, but again, it was unencrypted or voice traffic. So again, German-speaking operators could listen to it. And a key aspect of this German communication was their lighthouses and coastal installations along the channel, because these posts all had HF wireless sets and tended to sort of chat to each other. A lot of it was complaining about their rations not turning up and things like that. But equally, the famous Channel Dash in 1942, when Scharnhorst and Eisenhower made it through the channel, that operation was identified by coastal Y operators because they had lighthouse keepers basically handing on the fleet from one lighthouse to the next and saying, you know, you want to look out, there's something interesting coming. And then we're listening on the other end going, oh, is there something interesting coming? Sadly, the whole Scharnhorst and Eisenhower is an intelligence failure for a variety of other reasons, and the two ships got through. But Y did their bit in that process. Also, a number of the Wrens involved described listening to these stations closing down in 1944 after the Normandy invasion as the coast falls to the Allies. You get these people sending their kind of last messages from the lighthouses before switching off. So what is the effectiveness of this? The levels of intercept varied, as I told you on the map earlier, from some parts of the coast were picking up very, very little traffic. Other areas, particularly off East Anglia and South Yorkshire and in the Channel, were very, very busy. So in the latter part of the war, some of the stations up north and out west, St. David's and places like that, closed down quite early on. The staff are moved, sort of concentrated down into the southeast. One of the other advantages, it becomes clear that the Germans are constrained in the amount of voice wireless they can use. Because the E-boats become aware that they're being listened to, it forces them not to talk to each other. And there's a kind of negative effect there that even though you're not hearing them, you're making their operations more difficult because they're having to not communicate. Nonetheless, they continued to use wireless and they would do things, for example, even if they weren't going to talk on the radio, they would test it in harbour before they left. So you simply had to listen. And if you heard a carrier wave come out of Calais for a few minutes and then switch off again, you'd be like, all right, they're out tonight. And a number of operators described the fact that if you knew the bearing to the individual channel ports, you didn't need that cross-reference. If a signal came out on that specific bearing, you knew it was a ship starting up in the harbour and they were on their way out that night. So a definite intelligence benefit there. There are a number of reports on Coastal Y because the Navy was assessing how effective it was, one thing or another. And there's a report, the historical memorandum on coastal stations. In the Nore Command, with its intelligence centre at Harwich, traffic from E-boats was heard with almost monotonous regularity from 1941 to early 1945. Their own officers in charge were always most capable, and the exploitation of VHF and the collaboration of ships in the convoy routes was brought to a fine art. Again and again, convoys were given warnings that the enemy was lying in wait or mine laying ahead of them. This is the key part. It is incontestable that the VHF Y organisation in the Nore Command saved the country an inestimable number of ships and lives. So, rather unsung service, but nonetheless one that made a very significant contribution to the rather unglamorous world of coastal convoys. And again, a small piece in the vast jigsaw that is the signals intelligence operation of GC&CS. And that's where I'd like to finish, I think, if anybody has any questions.
You mentioned the initial, very unusual way of sending secret messages via the post office. Did they never use motorcycle messages?
Not that I'm aware, no. Certainly it isn't in the paperwork I've seen. I mean, they get telephones pretty quickly.
Was that speech or was that telex?
A mixture. I mean, the operational intelligence centres have teleprint links, as far as I'm aware. Do you have a view? Sorry, I should introduce Pat, who was actually served in the Coastal Wire Service and was one of the instigations for this research. So she's come along to correct me on all the things I get wrong.
That was absolutely fascinating and accurate. Thank you. We had teleprinters certainly at the stations further from Lurchdale Park. And once we'd got a signal complete written down, we would teleprint this to Bletchley, for instance, from Withernsea or Lyme Regis. I was never at one of the stations really close or closer to Bletchley, and I know they did use couriers, dispatch riders, but they wanted the information immediately, and so teleprinters were the fastest way. And, of course, we had chats with teleprinter operators, but it was all very one-way traffic.
Were they writing it down in German, or were they translating it on the fly? And how can anybody write as fast as anybody can speak? Were two girls doing all separate sentences?
Well, we all had to have fluent German, and I did a German test in Liverpool in the Leiva building before doing my general Ren training. I had learnt German from my grandfather's Austrian refugee cook because it was very boring at home in the country in wartime. And I did a lot of talking with her, and she did a lot of talking to me. And so when I joined the Rens, I didn't have school German, but I had very fluent Austrian-accented German. And, you know, we were just trained by Freddie to write down exactly what we heard. As David was saying, if it was operational, they wouldn't have time to code it, and they would talk to each other, and they would say, I've completed my laying, or there is a British destroyer so many degrees, or whatever it was. You wrote down these German words. If it was Enigma code, they used... am I going on too long? They used a phonetic alphabet, which started Anton, Bertha, Cesar, Dora, Emil, Fritz, and so on. And you wrote down, you know, E, E, F, G, or whatever, in groups. If it was Morse, well, you were also writing it down. Everything we wrote down was in German. And sent to Bletchley as German.
You have to remember, of course, that this kind of conversations, it's not a flowing conversation. It'll be a quick 20-second remark by someone, and then there'll be just an acknowledgement from the other end, and then a pause, and then maybe a response. It's not a constant conversation. It's short bursts of speech spread out. One of Pat's other stories, by complete coincidence, I was looking for an image of an e-boat to show you all, and I came across this slide on the internet. As I said, this is a particular e-boat.
Yes, E-41, yes.
And Pat actually listened to the to reports on this particular vessel, didn't you?
Yes. Actually, I was at Withernsea and then at Lyme Regis and then at Dover. So I wasn't actually on the main part of the East Coast. And they were picking up this boat, among others. The captain of this, Bobby Fimmon, was a very well-known character over the signals that they were getting on the East Coast. And one of the chatty signalmen up on one of these boats was saying to another one, did you know that Bobby Fimmon's crew are all going on leave next week? And the other signalman said, oh, sie machen alle Kinder was. They're all going to make babies. And, and I think this signal went to the nearest naval base because it actually was quite useful information to know that that e-boat wouldn't be operating in the next week or so.
There's two services involved. The one I haven't really touched on is an operation called Headache, where they discovered that this system was very effective. And the next logical step was to put it out at sea. And so they trained German-speaking wireless operators, many of whom were actually, they spoke German because they were emigres from Europe. And they were positioned on destroyers with a similar VHF setup so that they could listen to German vessels actually while they were operating at sea. And as I understand it, a huge proportion of the ships that were involved in Neptune in the invasion planning had Headache operators on board, intending to listen to precisely these kind of vessels that were the main threat to the invasion fleet. The other special preparation that goes on for D-Day, which is kind of a separate lecture. The piece I wrote an article about in the Friends magazine, some of you may have read, was about the wireless operation in Hut 18, formerly Hut 8. They had a HF intercept station installed in there for D-Day in order to cut down the time delay between intercept of naval traffic in particular and getting it to the codebreakers. And so just for the period of D-Day, they had a Y station actually here on site at Bletchley Park. It's the only time, as far as I'm aware, that they actually did intercept at Bletchley. And that was precisely intended to listen to German Kriegsmarine Enigma channel traffic so that they could identify if the Germans were going to do anything against the fleet. The operation worked that in the mornings they would listen to particular frequencies that didn't necessarily contain tactical information but were good for cribs. And a lot of people think about Enigma changing at midnight. Kriegsmarine Enigma in the channel changed at midday. And if you think about it, actually, if you're doing most of your operations at night, having your ciphers change at midnight isn't a very convenient time. It would change at midday. And because we're on double summer time, that's 10 a.m. So basically, they would come online at 10 a.m. and listen to these particular frequencies that would give them good cribs. And as soon as they got a crib off those frequencies, that would go to a bomb machine. They'd get the keys for the day, they'd come back, and then switch frequencies to the ones that were operationally most significant. And this enabled them to listen to German naval command in France as the invasion fleet was crossing the sea. And there's a recorded incident where Hut 18 picked up a signal ordering the German fleet in Brest, which weren't, it was not so much E-boats, it was slightly larger vessels, Bevorstung boats and torpedo boats, as they're called, which are a larger German coastal vessel. And a message was intercepted at midnight on the 5th, 6th, telling that fleet to sail at 4 a.m. to intercept the invasion fleet. And because Bletchley were quick enough to process that signal, translate it and forward it, it was in the hands of Admiral Ramsay by 4 a.m. before those ships had actually sailed. So the intelligence cycle is fast enough, even with Enigma at that point, to give real-time operational information to the fleet. What happened was that they sailed out of Brest, sailed up towards the convoy, broke through the Allied smoke screen that had been laid to protect the flank of the D-Day convoy, and came up against HMS Rodney. Rodney fired a number of 15-inch shells at them, and they nipped back through the smoke screen. And one of them was sunk, but the others sort of hightailed it back to Brest. But it shows the combination of intercept services that are available. You've got Pat and her friends on the cliffs at Abbott's Cliff, and along the south coast, you've got the headache operators on the ships themselves, and you've got the more conventional high-frequency Y service in operation as well. So you've got a complete coverage of the whole sort of bandwidth of German signalling at the time.
Was any of the information shared with RAF Coastal Command? I mean, was it all naval information kept in the Navy, or was there any dissemination?
Well, there was dissemination across, because they were also, I mean, Pat will support me on this, they were also picking up aircraft voice traffic as well. So the reporting that was also part of the picture, although they were focusing on Navy. I mean, did you listen to aeroplanes as well?
Well, they used to get a bit sort of hard-pressed at the interception stations of the Luftwaffe now at Capel Curig, now Abbott's Cliff, where I was, and we used to go and help them out. And, of course, the Luftwaffe didn't have time to code anything, but they had a sort of game, in a way, of they were the cowboys and the RAF were the Indians. And they would say, Achtung, you know, Indiana Lynx or whatever it was. And this was no use to Bletchley, so it didn't go anywhere near Bletchley, but I suppose it was some use to the RAF to know that that's what they were saying. So we used to quite enjoy hearing a totally different kind of traffic from the naval traffic.
One of the other things they would listen to were the German coastal batteries on the Pas-de-Calais. And one of the particular coastal batteries there, Battery Lindemann, was capable of reaching Dover at maximum range. And an operator describes in the lighthouse at South Foreland, listening to the Germans practice firing the gun. And there's a spotter plane flying, talking to the Lindemann battery, going back and forth, and shells are landing in the channel. And then the aircraft operator says over the air, increase the range a little bit, you might hit the lighthouse. And there, of course, they're all sitting in the lighthouse listening to this. And so it was the only time she had got under the table during the intercept process. Fortunately, the Germans didn't increase the range and try and hit the lighthouse. And there's an operation in particular. There was the Munsterland, which was a German. They had these sort of blockade runner merchant ships that they would send all around the world to acquire particularly important raw materials that they needed. And of course, they had ships going to Japan and back as well. And these merchant ships, the final part of their journey, they basically had to do a dash up the channel. And Munsterland was identified, because it was attacked and damaged, it was identified down in the Bay of Biscay. And they were able to use Coastal Intercept to identify when it sailed and made its way up the channel. And it had been attacked by the RAF, damaged sufficiently that it had to put into Boulogne for repair. And then it came out of Boulogne and made its last effort to get round to Germany. And Coastal Wine Dover picked it up, and our coastal batteries at Dover were able to engage it and successfully sink it off Cap Grenet.
You mentioned the intercept staff on ships for D-Day. Did they never put them on the coastal escorts?
Yes, they did as well, yes. Yeah, that service began on coastal escorts in 43, I think, and then they train a load more for the D-Day fleet. They also use a few in the Mediterranean, trying to listen to the Italians. There was actually one team of coastal Y operators were sent to Tunisia in 43 to listen to Italian, because the Italians were using sort of their equivalent of E-boats along the African coast. And they found a hotel high on a cliff in Tunisia, which is now still a hotel. And they set up in there for a while, but it became apparent fairly quickly that they weren't hearing sufficient traffic to be terribly useful. But there was an overseas branch of the organisation.
You started off mentioning the German and the Norwegian, but we seem to have drifted down to Dover and so on. Is there anything to report of the original Norwegian and German?
Up north? Well, certainly the stations Withensee up near Hull is quite a busy station, because although the Germans are sailing from ports in the Netherlands, which are too far away to be intercepted directly in harbour, by the time they get to the mine channels up the coast, they're inshore close enough that they can be detected. There were occasional incidents when they were able to hear stuff from as far away as Norway. And the main intercept station at Scarborough, they sent voice operators up there during when Scharnhorst was finally sunk in 43, when they were worried about her operating off the coast up there. They installed a number of voice operators in what was normally the Morse station at Scarborough, and they did some listening up there. Whether they actually heard the vessel or not, I don't know. But they thought it was certainly worth a try. But the main problem you have is it's only kind of a 30-mile range, so if they're off the Norwegian coast, unless you get peculiar atmospherics that make it possible.
Just briefly about Withensee and Scarborough. Withensee, we heard a lot more HF, long-distance German traffic, than most of the stations. And we had endless messages from Elbe-Weser Radio, which was, I think, a control on the Baltic. We were covering the sort of exit from the Baltic and that part of the North Sea, and we got some signals on HF which didn't seem to conform to German routines, and the Germans were very systematic. And we eventually discovered these were German tanks in Russia talking to each other, and because of a skip distance where the signals went up and hit the ionosphere and came down, we were picking up these tanks. They were not of any interest to anybody, but it was a bit weird. And two of us were sent up from there to Scarborough for a short time to try out frequencies. And it was an extraordinary place, Scarborough, because it was like a great big hangar underneath the race course. And at the time I was there, they were only listening to U-boat traffic. And the thing was to get a direction finding fix on any U-boat that came up and spoke. U-boats did not come up much and speak, obviously. And if one did, the man in control in the center stopped everybody practically breathing while they contacted all the direction-finding stations to try and get a fix on this boat before it went down again. I find it a very grim sort of place, and I was glad to get back to Withensee, but it was interesting. David mentioned the headache operation when we were persuading the Germans we were going to land at Cap Grenet, which was just opposite our windows at Abbot's Cliff. I was in the direction-finding tower, and on aerial shots you can still see this circular base where the tower was on top of the cliff near Abbot's Cliff Station. And I'd been there overnight and was coming off watch at 8 in the morning, and this was not very long before D-Day. And I noticed coming over the cliff a whole line of people who are evidently senior staff officers, and in the middle of them, what looked like Monty's Blackberry and Churchill in a cap. And I was extremely nonplussed because I knew you had to salute senior officers, but only when wearing a hat. And as at that time in the morning, I was wearing a duffel coat and bell bottoms and obviously not wearing a hat. The only thing to do was to wave to them all and say, hello, good morning. And they all waved back and said, good morning, and proceeded on their way. I was very puzzled about this, but I think what was happening was that they wanted to be seen looking across at Cap Grenet and that this would be reported back because during that period before D-Day, all sorts of things were happening and bits of the Mulberry were going passed under our cliff and barges and everything else. And I think that really, I can't think of any other explanation of what on earth they were doing at 8 o'clock in the morning on top of our cliff.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes.